Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. What originally started as a business conference for artists and fellow creatives is now being turned around to shine a light on our clients. From art buyers and creative teams to fellow producers and managers, this podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as the bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle a creative process to achieve excellence no matter what the medium. Today, we get into the differences between licensing and work for hire. Which one works better for who and when and why and how and where? We ask who owns what and how much of it. But of course, first, let's check in. I'm so excited because we're all in the same room.
Woohoo! We are in the same city. This is so exciting.
We're in the same room with three people and two microphones. Bianca, how are you?
Guys, I'm so well. I'm home in Melbourne for the first time in a year and a half. We celebrated Jackie Winter's 10th birthday on Saturday, so I've got some mad vocal fry this morning because it was about 6 hours of talking to everyone that I've ever known.
You sound like me.
I do.
It was an amazing night. I was just saying that I heard from multiple people, just overheard, you're much shorter than I thought you are. Like, and not just about you, Lara, but like many
yeah.
other people.
I heard this multiple times throughout the night. They're like, you have a bigger voice than your actual stature. Thank you.
It was great to put some, you know, from faces to names from artists who were coming from interstate, even some crossing the divide from New Zealand. And it was an amazing, amazing party with an amazing cake.
And many, many beverages.
We'll be posting some of those up to our Instagram at Jackie Winter. But yeah, a really fantastic 10-year anniversary. So yeah, we're delighted for everyone who came and sent us well wishes. So thank you. Moving on into our episode, going through our mini topics, some of the things that came up in our Slack this week, apart from party planning. This is one that's been going around a lot. I haven't had a chance to check it out. It's another podcast, the Hidden Brain podcast, the U2.0 series. And I think, you know, we were talking about how I need to hear things three times before I will listen to them. So, Lara, I've heard it from you. I've heard it from Penny. So I need it from one more person. But tell me what's so great about this.
Well, look, it's a podcast called Hidden Brain, which is an NPR podcast, all of which are pretty fantastic. This one is all about various sort of processes that go on in the brain and in our lives, but they're doing this summer series at the moment called U2.0, where they're sort of rehashing past episodes that have to do with designing your work and your life in a more efficient way to sort of make you feel more fulfilled and happier. And it's really, really interesting. So the first episode looks at the concept of deep work and sort of ties into the things that we've been talking about around getting away from Slack and getting away from reactive sort of emailing and things like that and finding time to really dedicate yourself to a single task. And then they look at things about, you know, designing your job around your personality and your likes and dislikes and yeah, all sorts of other stuff. It's definitely worth a listen. I've been really enjoying it.
Mm. Yeah, I know Penny, our social media manager, and Jess, one of our producers here, were telling me about this first episode this morning, and I'm really excited to listen to it. And one of the things that they mentioned that it talks about is the fact that creative people are sometimes the most structured people, which is, you know, an interesting thing. And it's actually something that I talk to my sister, who's a musician, a lot about. And not relying on this notion that creativity is kind of something that will come to you like out of, you know, this magic ether, but it's actually putting in the structure and the framework in place to allow creative work to happen, which is, I guess, what we kind of try and do here at Jackie Winter.
Totally. And then they have another episode where they look at how chaos is kind of important as well. Mm. So it's really, really interesting. Definitely worth listening to.
Awesome. Fantastic. And what does it have to do with the band U2?
Oh my God, Jeremy. How long have you been waiting to crack that the whole time?
Sorry, I wasn't listening to you. I was just like, should I do the Bono or...
No, you know what? That's great. Okay, that's good. That goes in the book.
Next up was, again, this is something that keeps coming up about the different companies just kind of being transparent with their documentation and hiring process especially. And this is one is called Culture Codes, and it's all culture decks from different companies. So we talked a few weeks ago or last week about startup pitch decks. And this one, Culture Codes, is all about kind of hiring and also kind of internal documentation and just really fantastic. I mean, this is kind of one thing that I love where, and I can't really stress this enough about looking to other businesses to really open your brain in terms of figuring out how you can kind of bring it into your own business? And I think in the early days of starting Jackie Winter, I always kind of thought, well, this kind of strategy or this kind of thinking would never work for me because we're too small of a business. But I find there's always kind of something you could take. Bianca, what did you get from reading through some of these decks?
Well, I know the Netflix one is a personal favorite of yours, but I didn't read that. I just jumped into, I mean, there's some huge companies in there like Google and Uber and stuff like that. But the one that I kind of had a quick look at was Big Spaceship, which is a branded digital agency in Brooklyn. And theirs was kind of fun because there was a lot of things that were very similar to, I guess, how we work here in terms of autonomy. And the one that I really liked, which kind of goes into our next mini topic for the week, one of their values is talk like a human. And what they mean by that is instead of saying leverage, say use. Instead of saying action item, say to do. Instead of saying empowering consumers, just go home and try again in the morning. So I really liked that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. The Netflix one is really interesting because this brings up a concept about companies as families versus teams. And I think this is a real interesting one culturally, how to kind of think of a group of people that you work with. And I think there is some kind of criticism for people making workplaces that are like family in terms of whether that's actually kind of a healthy or appropriate thing to do. And Netflix uses the sports team kind of metaphor, which kind of might sound a bit corny, but I actually think it actually is really relevant, especially as someone who plays and is very into sports. So yeah, reading some of these and figuring out how these companies structure themselves has been a great read. Bianca, you put another blog post up as well about speaking kind of normally, which is something that you just highlighted as well. What is this piece about?
So this was a piece from a blog called AdAged, adaged.blogspot.com.au. I can put the link in our show notes. But I think I have the vocabulary of a primary schooler, which is kind of embarrassing, but at the same time, I really do value clarity. And this was a really funny article. George Tannenbaum on the future of advertising, the decline of the English language and other frivolities. The article was titled, "I No Longer Understand," and it kind of starts, "I'm fast coming to the conclusion that I no longer share a language with many of the people around me. In fact, in many meetings, I take a sheet of paper, remember paper, and start marking down words people use that I don't know the meaning of. Or better, words that are so overused, so vague, so pretentious that they have no meaning altogether." And I think this, I mean, we talk so much on this podcast about language and how important it is. And yeah, I mean, this leads so beautifully into our next mini topic about people are sharing their favorite petty phrases to use in work emails, and they're pretty great.
Yeah, so this is, I'm surprised this is our first BuzzFeed link on the podcast, but yeah, this is writer Danielle Renee asked her followers on Twitter to share their favorite phrase to use in a professional clapback. I had to look up what a clapback is. Laura,
Jeremy is so old.
What is a clapback?
Just when you're like, I don't know how to explain it. How do you explain a clapback? Like a rebuttal, like a comeback, but like a petty one.
Yes. Well,
like a subtle one.
It is also a song by American rapper Ja Rule. That's the etymology
here.
I
see you reading from your screen here. This isn't knowledge you had already.
Shut up.
But anyway, no, these are really great. My favorite is the one that she shared at first, and I use it a little too much as well. Per my last email.
Oh, God.
When you're just pointing out that they haven't read it properly that you've already told them.
Yeah, I think this cuts even a bit deeper than the Vice one that we put the other week. Oh, going forward is another one. In an effort to maintain clarity/transparency, the worst one, I think, for me was any updates on this?
Mm. Oh.
This is so cringe. I actually had this one client who would email me these super short emails that would just say, "Bianca, please advise on the status of the artwork. No hello, no thank you." And it was, I just, every time I got an email from this particular client, I really didn't want to reply because it just felt rude.
But I've done as well, or I've had to do before in like really sticky situations where I've had to actually like send someone a screenshot of like an earlier conversation because they just were denying something. And it's so awkward, but you kind of have to sometimes.
Well, 77,100 people agreed with you on BuzzFeed. That per my last email is a clear winner in this petty work phrase.
I'm glad we know that. Thank you, BuzzFeed.
We will put all the links to these pieces in our show notes, which you can view at our podcast site at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz, as well as our tiny letter, which is gaining a bit of steam. So if you haven't signed up for that, want to know each week when our podcast comes out and have kind of links to all these as well, if you can't be bothered listening to us, you can sign up for that at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. Moving on into our first and only topic this week. This is one that we've really kind of had on deck for a long time that we wanted to cover. It's a topic that we're very kind of passionate about. And in the past few weeks, we have been kind of doing really only single topics because we've hit such a kind of a rich vein of information that we've wanted to kind of get into. So we're really going to start and hopefully scratch the surface of work for hire versus licensing and just kind of really dip our toes into the whole value-based pricing topic, which is a very hot button issue for a lot of people for a lot of different reasons as well. So look, we want to cover what does it mean to work for hire and how does licensing and the licensing model different in a world where creative work can be commissioned through many different ways, and the way that we kind of ascribe value for things is changing so much. We thought it'd be useful to explore these two topics as, I guess, the two sides of this argument or equation. So I thought we'll start off by first defining work for hire, like we do with everything else. What does this actually mean? B, this is something we've been working on together for quite a long time, so I thought you can maybe get us started.
Awesome. So I'll start with a very loose definition. So work made for hire can be defined as roughly one of two things. The first being a work made by an employee in the course of his or her employment. And the second is certain types of specially commissioned works made by non-employees. And when we're talking about work for hire versus licensing agreement, at the crux of this, we're really talking about authorship. So when we talk about authorship, if something is work made for hire, then the author of that work would be the person or the entity who is making the hire. So I'm employed by Jeremy, I'm employed by you at the Jackie Winter Group. So anything that I produce while engaged as an employee of the Jackie Winter Group is property of my employer. So this first type of work for hire agreement is fairly easy to understand. If I'm hired by a company as an employee, then the company wants to be sure it owns everything I create on company time. And that's because it would be an administrative headache and nightmare to keep track of who owns what part of what project over a period of hopefully many years of employment. So making the corporation the author takes some of this headache away. The second type of work for hire agreement is a little bit more complex. So every now and again, a client, in our case, especially a pretty large corporation, will commission a freelance creative, usually someone with specialized skills, to create a piece of specialized work for them and ask that they execute that work under a work for hire agreement. Because the phrase work for hire transfers all rights to the piece of work, whether it's an artwork or a piece of writing or a piece of software, and that includes moral rights, because it transfers all rights to the buyer and allows the buyer to claim the work as their own. As an agency, we generally prefer to work under licensing agreements where our artists retain copyright and moral rights to their work. So that's essentially the difference between work for hire and licensing. Well, that's more the definition of a work for hire agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is kind of one of the, when I say it's kind of a thorny issue, it is because we, you know, our business, and I think illustration and most image making, like photography, for example, has worked under the licensing proposition for a really long time. And I think that in the current creative economy as well, this is kind of one of the easiest or the most fair way to put value on work. But I guess, Laura, maybe before we kind of get stuck into that, let's look at the flip side. How does licensing differ from work for hire?
Yeah, sure. So as B just explained, you know, under a work for hire agreement, the copyright is automatically attributed to the employer. But as an alternative to fully assigning copyright to someone else, it can also be licensed. So whilst assigning a copyright, Jeremy, you always like to say this, is similar to selling a house. The original owner no longer has any claim over it. Licensing, on the other hand, is a bit more like renting. So the owner or the copyright holder grants permission to the other person for them to use that creative product in certain ways for a certain amount of time. So the creator still technically owns the work. They're still the author. But through a license, which is usually accompanied by a license fee, the client rents the rights to use it in whatever way that they need. So licensing like this exists everywhere. If you've ever watched a movie on Netflix or listened to a song on Spotify, played a game in the App Store, used an image from Getty, then you have come into contact with licensing in some way. And while I can't really elaborate too much on how it comes to play in those worlds, I can flesh out further how it works in our world of commercial art. So in general, license fees are calculated as a percentage of the creation fee based on the extent of the usage. So what's the creation fee? That's the fee for actually creating the work. So that's usually calculated on a daily or hourly rate based on how long it's going to take you to make whatever it is that you're commissioning. So from there, a variety of factors are considered, like the reach of the client, how the work is going to be used, when it's going to be used and for how long. And all of that information affects the total value of the final product. So how much you as a client are going to gain from it. So that's used to figure out what percentage the usage fee should be. And a license can really be as extensive or as restricted as needed. You can even license all of the rights, which I think Jeremy will touch on a bit later, which, you know, would give you most of the same freedoms as owning it outright, while still protecting the moral rights and style belonging to the author, as Bianca said. But yes, we'll touch on that in a second.
Yeah, look, some really interesting things there. I think, Laura, what you highlighted is specifically, you know, kind of our way of doing things.
Yes.
And that's kind of something that I developed, you know, through a lot of research and trying to figure out what kind of standards and best practices are. And I think that is something that is a bit kind of, is still controversial in some ways, especially when we're trying to figure out, yeah, what is the most fair way to kind of value this work that you can't really kind of tie it back to kind of time. We'll talk about alternatives as well. But if you go to Getty, for example, I always kind of point clients to this, but that gives you a very kind of clear example, or any kind of stock. Well, not any, but Getty is a really good one because they have a really great pricing calculator where you can pick an image and you can see all the different ways that they kind of deal with kind of factoring. I looked at this kind of once and tried to reverse engineer it, and there's an insane amount of math that kind of goes into figuring out, okay, how do you attribute the different way that you're going to use this, or the different kind of economy that it's going to be shown in, and all these kind of different factors. So it is a very kind of complex thing that a lot of thought kind of goes into. But B, also kind of calling back to something that you said about, you know, working for someone else. You know, it's when work for hire works when, you know, you are working for another place, and, you know, that workplace needs to kind of own that for kind of ease of use. And that's where I think we're getting into a lot of really interesting territory, because a lot of what we talk about is how the freelance economy is becoming a very dominant workforce. And effectively, in a freelance economy, there is, like, you are not working for anyone effectively, or you have multiple kind of bosses. And that is why this question is kind of coming up so much now, because of this whole idea of ownership and licensing is so prevalent. And again, Laura, like you were saying as well, we do come into licensing deals kind of all the time. One of the biggest things, I think, coming from Australia, people talk about all the time, is like, why can't we get Game of Thrones here at the same time as States? And that took, you know, how, I don't know, like almost 10 years. And that is specifically because of licensing deals, why things are more expensive in certain areas. It all comes back to licensing. So it is, you know, it is the fabric of trafficking creative content in kind of many ways. And again, when we talk about, you know, why is it working? It's because the basic metaphor here, there's a few that I always kind of talk about. One of them is the plumber. So basically, you know, a plumber, you've got a kind of a leaky faucet, your house is flooding, you need to call somebody, the plumber comes over and he spends 2 seconds kind of like fixing a drain, and he gives you a bill for, you know, $500. And you're like, why is this $500? You were here for kind of a second. It's like, well, it's a second plus the 30 years I knew which thing to close to get the drain fixed. So this has very similar parallels to creative work. Another example that I use to kind of bookend that is one of my favorite designers, Paula Scher, one of the founders and partners of Pentagram. She talks about drawing the Citibank logo, and she literally has this kind of in her presentations, which is the Citibank logo, a multi-billion-dollar multinational corporation. She was sitting in the meeting. They were talking about the brief, and she sketched out the logo, the umbrella on top of the city, in about 5 seconds. And I'm sure she didn't charge kind of 5 seconds of her time for that. So how do you kind of qualify that? That's kind of a question, you know, that we ask. And really, licensing kind of is the answer to that. So we know how that kind of benefits creatives there. Laura, I'd like you to talk a bit more about how it really can benefit clients as well at the same time.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's pretty simple, really. Clients and creatives need each other. You know, creatives need clients to give them great projects that will allow them to grow and sustain their practice. And clients need creatives to give form to their ideas so that they can increase business for themselves or for their own clients. Licensing, you know, absolutely has its flaws, like all methods. But, you know, as far as we can see, it is the best method we have of keeping that delicate ecosystem alive. You know, it can be hard to understand the benefits when you're staring down the barrel at a usage fee. But looking at all the options that we have to work with, licensing really is the best way we have to ensure that the system continues to function healthily without jacking fees up across the board. And I guess essentially it exists to help both clients and creators alike. You know, a model like this allows creators to charge fairly for their work using this value-based pricing system that Jeremy's touched on. And it means that clients only pay for what they use, you know. So it means artists can pay their bills and afford to keep creating amazing stuff for a living. And that's not just good for them, but it's good, or actually vital, for clients too. Without working creatives, there'd be no one around to bring their awesome ideas to life. You know, and I don't think anyone wants to whack their little stick figure scamps up on a billboard anytime soon. So the whole theory behind licensing is that you only pay for what the actual value of the work is. So yes, that does mean that there are times when you might be paying a higher usage fee than others might, but that just means that the piece is going to bring in more value for your company. So it evens out. And I guess it is easy to get caught up as well in who actually owns the work, but when there's a clear understanding of everyone's needs, then hopefully the right balance between price and usage and rights protection can be found.
This is one of the other challenging aspects, because you say it's the most appropriate value, but that value is very, very subjective. I mean, like anything else kind of in the free market, and figuring out how that gets set and kind of what is fair. But I mean, I love metaphors talking about this, because it is such a difficult thing to get your head around and trying to, especially trying to get everyone to understand. But I, you know, you said the same thing about the rent for buy. It's kind of the same thing. Like, our economy is moving towards kind of a shared economy as well. Like, it's less about kind of owning things. You look at kind of Uber, what, like, it's like, yeah, people are not kind of owning cars. So it's like the necessity to actually own something is becoming less and less. And so there is this idea that, yeah, renting things can be a bit more, well, you get a bit more bang for your buck.
Paying for what you use.
So.
And if you do use it a ton, then yes, maybe buying it is for you.
Yeah, exactly. If you need that car, if you're really going to have to drive every day, then yeah, you will want that kind of work for hire. And I think, yeah, you have to kind of balance out the kind of needs of everyone involved. I mean, B, there are situations, though, where work for hire and kind of that ownership is appropriate. Can you talk a bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, probably the most common case that I can think of where a work for hire agreement is more appropriate is when working in the corporate identity space. If you're hired to create a logo for a company and the company intends to use that logo incredibly broadly across all of its branding, products and merchandise, then that's where a work for hire agreement can be more appropriate. And that's basically because they, you know, they need ownership of it and they need to have the moral rights to be able to use it in any way they want. You know, they need the flexibility to use the logo in any way they please. So it doesn't really make sense for the artist to retain the copyright and the moral rights to the work. That being said, as the client can use the work very broadly and in any way they please, then the artist or the creator should be paid appropriately to actually transfer all of those rights to the client. So that's probably the most common case where a work for hire agreement is more appropriate, and the other might be in font use or something like that.
Well, even font use, though, I mean, most of the typeface and fonts that we work at are heavily licensed. I think that's one of the biggest creative areas, that it's licensed, you know, to the actual how many computers that can use as well, because fonts are kind of software, and getting into software licensing is a whole other kettle of fish. I mean, we're talking, I guess, more specifically about, I guess, the visual mediums that we work in, which is typically illustration, animation, and even kind of, yeah, GIFs is kind of bringing up a whole new sector of places that work can be used and can potentially be licensed. And it's an interesting thing that you talk about branding and design studios as well, because I think that's one of the one industries that we have a lot of kind of culture clash when we're trying to work with smaller design studios and trying to explain kind of our way of working. Because, well, from their perspective, their model is completely, okay, these are the head hours that are man hours that are worked, and so, like, why don't you kind of work the same? And it's interesting how that kind of has also kind of changed how design studios kind of operate. And I think the rise of strategy, and strategy being kind of this integral part of kind of advertising design studios as a way to kind of try to grow those kind of businesses. I mean, yeah, you look at something, I know it was a huge controversy here when Melbourne unveiled their old book logo, which I think is even gone now, but, you know, it cost $750,000 to do the logo. And so people are like, you know, it was an outrage, and like, you know, why are my tax dollars being used to kind of do this? But yeah, again, it's not, well, it did cost 750 grand. Where'd that where is that money spent? But a lot of it's strategy, making sure that the logo is going to do the right thing, but then also kind of rolling it out as well. And branding studios have really kind of, I guess, grown to meet those kind of needs at the same time.
So we have looked at work for hire now, and we've looked at licensing. Jeremy, I'd love to get your thoughts on whether there's a middle ground between those two.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think you have to kind of come back down to kind of the reason why we're such proponents and fans of licensing. And it really comes back down to this ecosystem. And one of the things that we've been working on for a while is kind of a self-initiated project called Use It or Lose It, which is all about kind of trying to put this information out there. And the whole thing being, it's like any other kind of ecosystem, everyone needs each other to kind of thrive. So if artists aren't making a living kind of doing their work, then they're not going to be available to actually do the work that other people need to do their job, etc. So it's really hard to kind of keep that balance. But you were just saying, like, well, yeah, on these big projects, like if you were creating kind of this content while you were working at Jackie Winter, it would be impossible to kind of keep tabs on what the license is for this and having to come back anytime you want to renew it, et cetera. So yeah, there's this idea, I think, and the reason there's a lot of resistance is because people are commissioning more and more work with more. And just like we talk about for GIFs, the reason why GIFs are so great is because, there's screens everywhere. And so people are commissioning more and more content, and nobody wants to kind of have the overheads of that as well. But also, we need to kind of protect people as well in terms of, well, for a lot of different reasons, because you read things every day about someone designed a logo for somebody. And then I think the last one that I read recently was the Rockefeller logo that was done for Jay-Z. Like, there was a huge lawsuit because, like, someone just kind of drew that. And then, there was never any agreement. And now it's kind of the logo for a multi-million-dollar company and kind of blah, blah, blah. And these things kind of happen all the time. If you're doing amazing kind of creative work and you're part of something else, like, yeah, everyone should be kind of part of it. And we'll talk about other models as well, because the model that we use is just kind of one way. What we try to do as well is try to tailor usage as well. So there is a middle ground between copyright transfer and licensing, and you can do a kind of a full assignment of rights, for example, rather than actually kind of transferring the copyright, meaning that you kind of retain your IP and moral rights. And you can also do different things in terms of how you handle exclusivity as well, and what kind of territories you give to somebody. So tailoring and understanding licensing is really kind of the best thing, and not trying to hit it with a really blunt instrument to just try to get all of your rights and get all the copyright and just make sure that you're completely covered. I think this puts creators in a really difficult and tight spot as well, because a lot of people, especially independent creatives, don't have the knowledge to have those kind of conversations. And I think I've seen some really, really large companies take advantage of this fact and not want to kind of engage in these conversations. So going back to what we're talking about, Use It or Lose It, I'm very passionate about bringing these conversations in. And it's really hard to kind of talk about it in a podcast because it is, like we said, we're just scratching the surface here. It's such a huge topic. So this is kind of, I guess, our first kind of baby step into kind of talking about it. But again, the reason you might want to kind of do, the reason that you might want to just kind of prune down what you have is especially because of the IP that you own and the moral rights that you own. But also in Australia, we have things called lending rights. We have the CAL, which is Copyright Agency, and we have ELR and PLR, which is rights that that libraries and other institutions kind of pay back to creators for lending kind of work out. And there was a massive campaign that we're going to link to, which is called Free Is Not Fair, which is all about this huge debate that was happening with copyright in Australia, where there was a lot of kind of pressure from companies like, Wikipedia, for example, arguing that, we can't afford to pay a licensing fee to put something kind of on an article. So Australia needs to kind of change to the more American system of fair use. And this has huge implications on a lot of artists, because a lot of these institutions, like in music, it's APRA. I know in the States, it's kind of something different. If you play music in a cafe or something, you get a kind of share of that back. A lot of our artists who work in publishing, which is a very kind of dire industry, really rely also on the royalties that are collected by these collecting societies and kind of given back to them. And signing over your copyright effectively gives that, like, you are no longer the author, and all those kind of fees go directly to the publisher. So yeah, you don't kind of get anymore. So that's another reason why I think copyright transfer is really kind of a last resort, but it does require people to be kind of empowered and understand that and not to give it away. away, because the more people that kind of give it away, the easier it becomes to kind of ask for it. And yeah, we're not trying to kind of set up a combative environment where this is kind of an argumentative thing. It's really coming back to that core thing that we're all kind of in it together there.
Ooh, a lot to go through. I think especially, you know, getting into like IP transfer and that, I think, is a topic for another episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, this comes up a lot in kind of animation as well. But like if you're using a lot of times, if you're designing special software or special methods that you kind of use to do things, or you're developing your models, when you give your copyright away, you're probably giving away a lot more than you even kind of know. And that is something that has to be kind of managed very delicately, because you're cutting yourself out of a lot of potential income. When you sign over copyright and you sign over the moral rights and someone else becomes that author, you are essentially giving someone then the ability to create a lot of future work that could be in your kind of style or using kind of your work. And again, I think this is it's an interesting kind of juncture where creatives really need to understand and protect their value. And I think this is something that I talk a lot about, why photography has become a bit of a threatened discipline, is because with the tools being completely democratized and everyone can essentially take, you know, high quality photos, everyone thinks they're a photographer, all clients think anyone else is a photographer as well, and therefore they can ask for these rights, because if someone says no, someone else is just going to come around and kind of do it. So you need to ask yourself as a creative, what am I doing differently that I'm kind of adding value to besides the kind of content of my work? And that's something that we try to kind of answer with everything else that we do outside of our own production representation.
I guess as well, like in terms of signing over moral rights, it's not just about, you know, potentially cutting yourself out of future income because they can see the processes and perhaps do it themselves. But it's also those, you know, as an artist, your reputation and, you know, sort of your visual reputation is your income, you know. And if your work is replicated badly, you know, in a way that people still think it is associated with you, that can be very damaging to your career. I mean, if the new owner totally defaces the work in some way, if they whack a big swastika over it. I mean, it's a pretty big sort of extreme example, but, you know, there's nothing you can do when that work is forever, you know, publicly associated with you. And that is going to be pretty detrimental to your career and to your income. But it's, you know, as I said, extreme example, but your style and your reputation are you. And it's important that you maintain control over that where you can. And, you know, and on top of all that, as the owner of the IP, the client is also able to sell that work onto other people without you receiving any sort of remuneration for it. And we see that kind of issue all the time.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of this is, it comes down to kind of legal language as well. And this is another area where I'm very passionate about kind of contracts. If you receive a contract from someone else, that contract is always going to be in that person's kind of favor. And I totally understand why clients want, and in some cases deserve, full ownership and full rights over things. And there are definitely occasions for that. But I think that is really should be the exception rather than the rule. So I think there are other models that are starting to emerge outside of licensing that I think are really interesting to kind of look at. One of them that I really love is working for equity. And this is something that, again, kind of came up from looking at other businesses and how they work. The first time I came across this was in one of my favorite businesses, Sandwich Video, run by Adam Lissagor. Hello, Sandwich. Are any of you guys familiar with that? They do kind of all the videos for a lot of kind of startup kind of product videos. They're really fantastic. And I think they have one of the best FAQ pages ever that kind of talks about the different, you know, what kind of projects they kind of take on and how that, like, well, yeah, they will kind of work for equity in a company if they feel there's kind of something there. We talked about tailoring exclusivity as well, and especially, or a lot of things that we spoke about in kind of royalties. I mean, royalties are effectively is a form of licensing and value-based pricing and subsidiary rights. So figuring out, okay, yeah, what other kind of alternative ways of kind of compensation? A big piece is also just kind of looking at the price of a project and, you know, and pricing it that way. And there's a podcast that I love called Businessology, which really kind of goes over value-based pricing in a much more kind of thorough way than we'll ever kind of get to here. So again, it's really about, just like when you're running a small business, you kind of do everything. You are the, you know, you're the marketing person, you're the IT person, you're the cleaner and janitor, but you're also kind of your own lawyer. So the more that you know about your own terms and your own kind of contract, the better that you can kind of negotiate with it, because it's the same thing as negotiating fees or their creative or timing. It's just another aspect of the project. And yeah, you got to know kind of what you're doing.
For emerging artists, one of my favorite resources in terms of breaking down what actually is licensing is a book that was put out by the AOR. AIY, which is the Association of Illustration in the UK, called The Illustrator's Guide to Law and Business Practice, which really breaks this down in layman's terms. And I recommend it to every producer that starts here, and it's one of my favourite publications.
Yes, B, you gave it to me when I first started working here 3 years ago, and it was wonderfully helpful in getting me started here.
And I recommend that book to people, no matter, it's from the AIY, which is an illustration body, but it's relevant to so many others. And the AIY, I like because even though it says, okay, Guide to Law and Business Practice, and they're a UK organization, I love the Graphic Artists Guild Ethical and Pricing Guidelines book. It comes out with a new edition kind of every 2 years. And that's really great because it has a more American perspective to kind of balance that out. So look, there's so much to kind of dig into. I really think this is essential reading, learning, listening for anyone kind of interested. We've barely scratched the surface on this. So I really would love to hear some further comments from anyone who has any other thing they want to kind of share or kind of talk to us about it. But otherwise, we'll put the links to all of this in our show notes as usual. And yeah, I think that'll do it for licensing for now. Closing out how we like to do every week is the most Melbourne and the most New York thing. Actually, B, I don't know. Were you in New York part of this week? Do you have anything that you could even contribute here? Or is this going to be an all Melbourne segment?
I'm back in Melbourne and it's totally all Melbourne. I stayed with my folks when I arrived and I woke up to the sound of kookaburras, which was so much nicer than waking up to the sound of sirens or someone rummaging through the trash outside my window.
Well, I can contribute the non-Melbourne thing this week because I've been in Toowoomba all week. And here are some cute facts I learned about Toowoomba. The first is there are 2 Uber drivers. That's it. There's just 2 Ubers.
And
poor one of the poor artists that was there with me caught an Uber from the airport not knowing this and just had to wait like an hour because one of the 2 Ubers was just busy doing other stuff. So that's adorable. And also there are like 11 subways and just nothing else. So,
like Subway Sandwich.
As in Subway
Sandwich.
Oh,
yeah, sorry. I'm like, that's a really robust public transport system someplace with 2 Uber drivers.
Subway is full of sandwich artists.
Speaking of sandwich artists, I think, yeah, the Melbourne thing that I was going to bring up was our amazing cake designer. I don't know, like, how big cake design is anywhere else, but it seems to be a very Melbourne thing. I'm going to just buzz market creative cake art from Melbourne. As soon as I saw this is a woman who made a Yoda cake as well as a kind of disturbing, like, it's just a guy's kind of midsection with no head, like totally ripped. Anyway, you'll get it when you see it. But yeah, our cake was a laptop that had a Jackie Winter bird on it that had pooed all over the cake. And yeah, the poo was edible. But I don't know. I just came up with that because, like, I was looking at this and I had to come up with a brief in 5 minutes. I'm like, okay, this woman can do anything. So, okay, like laptop, bird, poo, I don't know. And then I was like, what do you, and then she's like,
that's where my brain goes immediately as well.
And she was like, well, what do you want on the screen? And so we were just in Slack. I took a screenshot of our current Slack talking about what we're going to put on the cake, and that went on it as well. So yeah, it was a real Melbourne thing. But yeah, the most Melbourne thing was just getting everyone together at, 4 or 10 year anniversaries.
At a pub.
At a pub. There you go. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you both.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. We might be experimenting with a bit of a call-in thing happening in the next kind of couple of weeks. So make sure that you kind of stay tuned to all of our to all of our social media and our podcast page, where all of our archives and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And we send links out every Friday, our show notes and letting people know when the episode is out through our tiny letter at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff at soundcloud.com/jackiewinter. And may I say, he puts on an amazing live show. He played the party on Saturday and it was fantastic. It was a bit weird when he started playing the theme song. Bianca, who's sitting next to me, I just went over and gave her the intro in the middle of it. So yeah, that was interesting. interesting. But yeah, a big thank you to Jackie Winter for all his support and really fantastic music. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and give us a comment, please. More people that comment, the more people that can find us. In addition to surprising everyone here with my idea for a live call-in show, I also want to kind of think of a way to bribe people to kind of comment. So I don't know if that's legal or not, but I do want the comments. I will give you things in return. We'll figure out some way to do that. Anyway, details of everything on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. Laura, do you have any further thoughts on that at all?
No.